Hello, and welcome to episode 122 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a policy analyst, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is my interview with Scott Hechinger about bail reform in New York. Scott Hechinger is the founder and director of Zealous, a national initiative that activates, trains, and supports state and local public defenders in partnership with local organizations the people and communities defenders represent, an artist to leverage storytelling and new media advocacy strategies to break through the noise, complicate prevailing narratives, and end mass criminalization. Zealous was an outgrowth of Scott's work as a public defender for close to a decade, first at Partnership for Children's Rights, representing low-income families and children in special education litigation, and then at Brooklyn Defender Services, representing people charged with crimes and who couldn't afford an attorney. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Scott.
So glad to be on, and it's been way too long time coming. We've been trying to do this, but it's my fault, and now I'm glad
to
face with you.
I think we've tried to do it several times, and it just never worked on the schedule, and I'm glad we finally made it work. I always ask the same first question. How did you get from kind of wherever you started to where you were a public defender and then to where you were starting organizations designed to end mass incarceration?
Oh, man.
It's a big question. Well, no, I always like to start big.
No, it's a good first question. I mean, I'll maybe take it in three snapshots. Like early on, so I grew up in Washington, D.C. I was a seventh generation Washingtonian. I have no idea why, but my folks got off the boat in the early 1820s in Baton Rouge, Germany, escaping violence there and headed straight to the swamp. And we're there ever since. And so I've broken the legacy. So my folks are upset with me. But I remember in D.C., I grew up looking up to my grandfather. My grandfather was, like me, a white privileged man. He was a business owner, and he was also appointed the first chairman of the D.C. City Council by Lyndon Johnson. And he could have just gone about his business and not really, and kind of continued to, or amassed wealth and not focused outward, but he really did what he could to not give back, but to like give forward. And I remember his office was down in the basement of his house. His wall was filled with photos of him shaking hands with civil rights leaders, marching on Washington, meeting with business leaders. He was among the first to hire Black people into senior management positions and did a lot of work with NAACP. He, as the chairman of the DC City Council, he desegregated the police force. Now, hindsight is 2020. That clearly has not changed things despite a desegregated police force in most places, but it was revolutionary at the time. And around conversations with regard to the mandatory minimum sentences for gun violence, he was adamantly opposed to it, even though he was very for gun control. I remember this handshakes wall. It was his, I called it the handshakes wall. And that really drove me early on just to give a sense of public service. And I really looked up to him. And also just like how to use, or the obligation really that I thought of using his power and privilege to not waste it and to actually to pay it forward. Second snapshot, law school. I went to law school to put myself in the best position to, I guess, do what my grandfather did in different formats. He wasn't a lawyer, and I was the first person in my family to go to law school. But I remember not knowing exactly what issue it was going to be and how I was going to kind of hone in on that issue. And within the first day or so during like the orientation, I heard Brian Stevenson speak. He was a professor. I went to law school at NYU School of Law. And it was a speech that many have heard. It never gets old. It's powerful. It's deeply personal. The two things that stuck out to me stick out to a lot of people, which is that criminal justice is the civil rights issue of our time. And everyone's more than the worst thing they've ever done. And after that,
I'm pretty sure I've seen that speech three times and it's been amazing every time.
I get teary. Anyway, after that speech, I was like, I know what my issue is. It's going to be criminal justice, and I'm tethering myself to that guy for whatever it's worth. And I wound up, my first law experience was doing really early state-by-state research on mandatory minimum or mandatory juvenile life without parole sentences that in very small part supported his ultimate argument in the Supreme Court in Sullivan to end the juvenile life without parole for juveniles and non-homicide cases. And he was the one who encouraged me to become a public defender. I mean, he asked me, he was like, I didn't know what I want to do my first summer. He's like, well, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to work with people. I want to work on the front lines. I want to fight the system. I want to be, you know, I want to be as close to where the injustice is as possible. And he's like, you should be a public defender. And New Orleans just set up an office. For the first time, it was one of the silver linings of Hurricane Katrina. And I headed down there and saw public defenders, both as activists. I remember Steve Singer, the head of the office, getting literally dragged out in handcuffs, being held in contempt of court for making simple legal arguments. And I also saw defenders as storytellers. My job down in New Orleans as an intern was literally, I was the runner. And the runner was the person who needed to meet as many people as we possibly could in the 30 minutes before there'd be these mass arraignments in the New Orleans Parish Prison loading dock to find out as much about them as we could and connect as much as we could and then literally run these like short stories, the three blocks in the blazing hot New Orleans summer heat to the one public defender sitting in the witness box in the magistrate judge's courtroom where they looked through a video screen at a sea of orange jumpsuits and indiscernible black faces and just basically set bail one after the other. And I don't know if it was masochist, if it was a horrific summer, it was a moving summer, but it was like, this is what I wanna do. I'm gonna stop there because there's more to talk about, but that was how I decided to become a public defender and the how I got to starting this crazy thing called Zealous. Is the next part, but I feel like I've already been talking too long with this question.
Well, I do have to ask you said you grew up in DC, and I think we're both of a relatively similar age, and so I have to, your answer may be this wasn't part of your growing up, but I have to ask about go-go music and DC punk, if you're down with any of that.
Both, and actually primarily go-go. I'm a drummer. When I say I'm a drummer.
Me too! Hey! I'm a drummer too!
Dude! I'm so glad we finally connected. We found each other.
My dad's a jazz drummer. It's a small world. Yeah,
that's amazing. No, my grandfather, different grandfather on my mom's side, was a drummer. He was really into music. He was Mr. Blues. He was like a DJ, but he had this drum set in his basement. That's now my drum set. It's a 1962 Slingerland Black Mother of Pearl. Amazing.
Oh, nice.
That I got fixed up. And yeah, when I say I'm a drummer, unfortunately, since my 6-year-old was born, I've kind of not been drumming. I'd like to get back into it. But yes, go-go music, I was obsessed with it. I was in a go-go band. I literally played drums, not like in a very big go-go band, but we had our own school like go-go band. That was going to go-go's. For those of you who don't know, DC, it's a combination. The way that I would describe it, it's like hip hop, funk, like Latin rhythms, heavy bass, and more than the music itself, the experience of going to a go-go, which is just people usually dancing in like really, really heavily in like basketball gyms. It was just a scene. So it is part of DC life and culture.
Yeah, I didn't live in DC, but one of my real joys as a young guy was passing tapes back and forth with people across the country, and that's really how I learned music. A lot of some of that stuff that would come back would have good go-go tracks on it and stuff like that. So that's how I got into it a long time ago. So throughout this interview, I suspect we're going to talk a lot about media and platforming. Since we're talking about your time as a public defender, yeah. Seems like a decent time to ask this. Do you have a theory for why defense attorneys are rarely nominated for judgeships and rarely get to participate in things like media roundtables on crime? We see every prosecutor in the world gets platformed. Every prosecutor in the world gets judgeships. Why do only half of the folks get who practice, or probably less than half of the folks that practice get that privilege? or those privileges?
Complicated question, different answers, and all kind of intersect. One is tied in with kind of broader conceptions in popular culture that's kind of inborn from the moment that we kind of are aware. We learn that police are heroes. That's the first thing we see in cartoons. And kind of next step is that public defenders, once you start learning about them, are unserious, uncaring, bottom of the barrel, might as well not be attorneys. And so there's this deeply embedded, understanding of who public defenders are, how serious we are about public policy, how expert we are on the system, how smart we are, how we have collective knowledge, and how as defenders and defender offices, we see just an enormous volume of cases. And so are able to actually see how the range of laws and practices intersect the harm that people we represent. We see how these lofty laws that are interpreted by courts are really applied every day. But that's not what everyday people think of. That's not what the general public thinks of. It's not what leaders think of. But and then beyond that, because of that public perception, which is more, it's both that we're hapless and we don't care and we're inexpert, but then it's also that what we do just want to get people out of jail, and like we don't care about public health and safety. We do care about public health and safety. We have very different ideas about how to actually achieve that. We're all family members. We all are living in these communities. We're all living in cities. We don't want people to get hurt. Unfortunately, this massive system that we have and the hundreds of billions of dollars that we spend is not actually getting us to a place of public health and safety. But what leaders kind of see, and I think what leaders fear, and this is why we don't get appointed into judgeships and why we don't get placed into positions of power, is that they fear the same kind of like political suicide that comes with being quote unquote soft on crime, right? So defenders get lumped in with this like quote unquote soft on crime narrative. And if they point public defenders, then, you know, that's opening them up to potential political attack for caring more about quote unquote criminals than victims, care more about, decarceration or abolition than safety, when those aren't mutually exclusive. Last but not least, though, it's also there's some self-imposition on this issue in public defender land. And I saw this firsthand. We don't learn media skill, like we don't really learn how to talk to media in law school. And then once we're in court, we are taught really importantly to be client-centered. And client-centered becomes, and just kind of looking at different defenders and defender offices, becomes no comment. Becomes, protective at all costs. There's feelings that we don't have, even from more kind of socially conscious folks that are more into social justice, that we shouldn't be speaking out. Because why is it our role? There's enough power dynamics inside of court, and that's like legit. Why are we replicating that on the outside? I don't think we need to, that defenders can't, just because defenders are talking doesn't mean that people we represent can't be. And so like we limit ourselves. And so that's where kind of the concept and now the work of Zealous really started, was early on asking, as I'm in court every single day with a massive amount of resources compared to other defender offices, 50 social workers, investigators, and relatively low caseloads, which unfortunately means like 80 to 100 only, which is insane. But still still 95% of the people I was representing pleading guilty, whether they're guilty or innocent, whether they've been stopped and frisked unconstitutionally, and they were silenced. And I was asking, like, why aren't we as defenders and as a defender office speaking out more? Why aren't we collaborating and thinking about non-extractive and non-exploitative ways to partner with the people we represent to breathe life into the systemic injustices that we're seeing? Why aren't we talking to press more? Instead of saying no comment, we're being reactive when they reach out about either a sensational case or even like an issue everyone's talking about, like bail. Why can't we actually identify an issue and proactively pitch it to them so that someone learns about it? Why aren't we using social media, et cetera? we're losing, you know, we're losing the battle over people's perceptions about crime and punishment, and what it's going to take to achieve public health and safety. And we need to get engaged smartly, strategically in those conversations. And then I think that then will lead not only to better policies, but hopefully more experienced people in positions of power.
Well, you brought up bail, and I know for a very long time, both of us have been screaming from the rooftops about New York's bail reform law as loudly as we could and as often as we could. So I guess we should start there.
Yes.
When did New York pass its bail reform law, and what were the major innovations in that law?
April 2019, bail reform was passed in New York. It went into effect in 2020. The major innovations were ending the possibility of judges to set bail in most misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies. Bail is an amount of money. It's supposed to be an incentive. It's an amount of money that after you're charged, bail is set. It's an amount of money to ensure you come back to court. You pay the money, and you're as long as you come back to court, even if you're found guilty, even if you plead guilty, you get the money back. It's not supposed to be a punishment, but in reality, the people who are filling, you know, our jails, 500,000 people around the country, thousands in New York City, are people who just like cannot afford to buy their freedom. And so for a certain class of crimes, nonviolent crimes, it blocked judges from setting bail. But what it also did was offer in its place additional resources for people who were released to get engaged with services, to give them reminders to show up to court. And before it even went into effect, it was being blamed for everything. Every single
We'll definitely talk about it. I want to go this very.
That's what it is.
Yeah, I want to go very deliberately because deliberately because there's been so much talk about this over the last few years. I want to make sure we hit all the points so that anyone who's listening has an idea why we get so frustrated by what's going on, what the major narrative has been.
So that's it. It was limiting the number of cases, the types of cases that where someone could end up caged on bail they couldn't afford. It was in recognition of the fact that we knew from data that bail was not necessary to ensure return to court. If we knew it before bail funds were around, we knew it certainly after bail funds were around, where we actually saw that in 96% of the time that judges set bail in misdemeanors, they were wrong. Bail wasn't necessary to ensure return to court. Bail funds paid their money, they weren't on the financial hook, and they still came back and overwhelmingly didn't get rearrested. So it was modest and reasonable.
And there was also a part about discovery, right? There was also
separating out the two. I mean, they're both pretrial justice reforms. Bail has to do with pretrial caging. There's intersections with discovery, which really means just evidence. But discovery reform in New York up until 2019 or up until 2020 when it went into effect, it was New York was one of the four most restrictive, least transparent states in the country when it came to evidence. Prosecutors literally were entitled by law to withhold the most important pieces of evidence until the day of trial. We're talking about witness statements, police reports, folks, when we would go to conferences outside of New York, we would talk about our discovery laws. Other defense attorneys, including in Texas that has the most progressive discovery laws, would look at us like we had three heads. What are you talking about? Like, how can you prepare for trial? And the answer was, you can't. But the other piece was, we never made it to trial because guess what? Either someone pleaded guilty because they were incarcerated and wanted to go home to trial, and or on top of that, they were completely in the dark. They didn't know what evidence was going to be used against them. And people are like, well, if they did it, they obviously know. But the truth of the matter is, so many times in our cases, it's like accomplice liability, where like how close were they saying I was, or like what, you know, how did they tie me to this crime? And obviously everyone knows how wrongful convictions happen all the time. So no, it was a major problem. And so discovery reform literally just brought New York in line with the rest of the country. That's literally all it did. And in what that means is not only allowing the defense and defendants to know the evidence against them, like in Texas, like in all the southern states, like in Florida, all the places you think would be like backwards, not. But it also strengthened protections for victims of crime that didn't exist before. So made it so that prosecutors could still request, or it could actually affirmatively request to withhold witness information and kind of firewall it between defender and the defense attorney. So the defense attorney might be able to see it, but they weren't under a strict obligation not to share, which was something new. And so there we go. Brought us in line with.
All right. So before we get to the rest of the details of what happened after that, probably, most people listening right now probably have a strong feeling about this in the first place, but nobody's probably seen it as many times up close and personal as you have. So could you at least just talk about why you think pre-trial release is so important? And I could talk about this for a week. You could probably talk about it for a week, but if you can just dig deep and give me a summary of what you think that, why do we care so much about pretrial release?
Number one, the Constitution, presumption of innocence. It's a thing, and I think we should all care about that. We're talking about caging people who have not been found guilty of anything, which is a whole other conversation, whether people who are guilty of something should be caged, but we're caging people based upon and the decisions being made at a moment when no one knows anything about what had happened within 24 hours of an arrest. Number one. Number two, the violence of pretrial detention and pretrial caging. The very same drivers of violence, and that's isolation, shame, economic deprivation, and violence itself, are the exact characteristics of places like Rikers. So we wind up sending people away pretrial, presumed innocent, under this kind of public safety rationale, and we're literally increasing the chances that they are going to come out far more damaged and more likely to get rearrested for violent felonies than before. So it's a public safety reason. Number three, why do we care about this? While their fo folks are facing the violence on the inside, think about the stuff that they're losing on the outside. And not just them. So they're losing jobs, they're losing housing, they're losing educational impact. But the people who were not arrested, their family members, elderly in need of caretaking, their children are being left without caretakers and without support and financial support and otherwise. So just enormous economic and social damage. Four, if you don't care about any of that stuff and you just care about your taxpayer money, it's an exceptionally expensive proposition. Based upon all that, it is over $1,000 per night, per person, without even any medical conditions, to jail someone on Rikers Island. It's more than the most expensive hotel room in New York City, or as much. There's probably one set, maybe a little more than 1,000, but it's enormously expensive. And at the end of the day, it's also just, as I was saying earlier, it's unnecessary. We know from data over a long period of time that one, at the same time that we decreased pretrial incarceration over the past 20 to 30 years, something like 80%, the same number, kind of the same percentage number of drop in major index crimes also went down. So, like, you don't need incarceration to reduce the number of crimes. We know that people show up to court. They just do. I know this from firsthand experience. We know this from data. And we know that when people are released, whether they're charged with violent felonies, misdemeanors, or nonviolent felonies, they do not get rearrested for violent felonies. And that's continuing through to today, which we'll talk about later. So we should all care about
So,
it.
and we also should care about, sort of facts and truth and things like that that should matter. Not long after the bill was implemented, the backlash started. We were both pretty involved in trying to scream back against it. Tabloids like the New York Post started publishing anecdotal and out often, and I did a lot of research on these particular cases, often outright fraudulent stories about people who've been supposedly let loose because of the new bail law, often before the new bail law had even been implemented. What do you remember about that period?
I remember being so angry and so frustrated. I expected the police and prosecutors to be fear-mongering and to be sensationalizing. What I didn't expect, and I should have, and now I do, was how gullible the media was. And it wasn't just the New York Post. it was New York Times. It was the big kind of the trusted, more trusted news sources that kept repeating these lies. And it was so brazen too. Like the anger was, it was so brazen even before, between April and January, the law hadn't gone into effect. And everything was getting blamed on it. I remember before, and this, you know, I'm Jewish, and I remember there were these attacks. There was like three assaults. There was this woman who was in serious mental health crisis, who slapped or assaulted in some way these three observant Jewish women. Obviously, I don't want that. Like no one should want that. The question then becomes: A, someone who's in a mental health crisis, will caging them help them? And then B, beyond that, how do we feel about weaponizing a tragedy?
Because there were a couple guys who got killed, if I remember, or there was some kind of tragedy the week before. And when they arrested her, they tried to act like giving her release was the same as ignoring this other thing that had happened a couple days before, if I remember correctly. Am I right?
That rings a bell, but it was so frustrating because it was just like they're using so cynically, you know, real concerns historically present around anti-Semitism and just like hate, you know, hate in general. When this wasn't, it didn't appear to be hate related because of the mental health issue, and who knows. But more than that, using you know, someone else's hurt to blame something that's totally unrelated. And I remember one of the women actually was so horrified. She reached out and spoke to the New York Daily News and a number of reporters, calling out the fact that she doesn't think that the woman who assaulted her should be sent to jail, and that she was really horrified by the fact that police and prosecutors and folks in power were using her hurt to roll back a policy before it even had gone into effect. So I just remember being angry and also then doing something about it, which was just, it was tweeting a lot. It was trying to share stories of success, folks who were out, trying to point out the fact that it hadn't started yet, talking about data, like even if bail reform had started, you can't judge any policy based upon short run statistics. Unfortunately, starting this project that we actually just relaunched called Justice Not Fear, where we identified, unfortunately, this all started by, you know, December, but we launched this thing that we heard actually helped prevent more rollbacks, that centered the issue of fear mongering as a social and racial justice imperative. So folks knew that this was happening. And two, out of public defender offices and organizers were legal experts were writing back debunks to all of these false public statements, to all of this bad media. And we wound up, we were asked for it by lawmakers, and we were able to provide lawmakers with the truth. We were able to provide the general public with the truth, and yeah, it was as effective as we could have gotten, but unfortunately, it wasn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, I mean, what is the old saying about papers and unlimited ink or whatever, you know, taking on, they just seem to be able to just keep coming and keep coming and keep coming in ways that, you know, I'm not sure I think we all fought pretty hard, but it's, you know, and the end result is that former Governor Cuomo stepped in and threatened to, if I remember correctly, hold up medical funds at the beginning of the pandemic if bail reform wasn't partially rolled back. So then they did roll it back. What parts did get rolled back?
Yeah, Governor Cuomo, the capital H hero.
He got a book deal out of it, right? That was the
in the dead of night, 3 weeks in, something like that to the pandemic. Empty halls. The Democratic lawmakers did this too, in halls that previously were filled with organizers who've been working for decades for this. Repealed or rolled back bail reform. And the primary ways that they rolled it back before even giving it even close to a chance to succeed was in that version was in the same way that the initial bail reform limited the number of cases. So like no misdemeanor, like more majority of misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies weren't eligible. It increased the numbers of nonviolent felonies and misdemeanors that were then eligible. Not all, and it could have been worse. That were eligible for bail. It also, even for those cases that weren't that were still not bail eligible, so the other misdemeanors and the other nonviolent felonies, it gave judges greater discretion in certain cases to jail them pretrial. So for example, if you get arrested for jumping the turnstile once, in the first shot, you're not eligible for bail. But let's say you got to get to that doctor's appointment and you can't afford public transportation, and you, like many folks can't, and they walk through an exit gate, a misdemeanor on top of a misdemeanor is jailable. Or take, you know, being arrested for low-level drug possession twice, or petty larceny, stealing to survive, or sleeping where you're not supposed to sleep. That's actually been a huge increase in the Rikers population since the rollbacks went into effect.
So we have, unfortunately, as the pandemic started to unfold, as this was all happening, we had a national increase in homicides. And some of this obviously also happened in New York. And since that spike in homicides, the tabloids and the NYPD have really never seemed to miss an opportunity to loudly proclaim that bail reform is the culprit. I know the answer to this already, but does this claim make any sense at all to you?
I don't know if your listeners or viewers are going to be able to see me, but I'm like throwing up my hands and again, rage. I'm smiling. So ridiculous.
The ones that watch us on YouTube can, the ones that are listening can't, but they now know.
There's so many things that are wrong with it. Okay. So number one, the absolute gall of police, let's just take the NYPD, who get paid an historic amount of money in the history of the world, and actually the most in all of the United States, $11 billion at least, and that's before a lot of other things get added, a year, ostensibly, according to them, to provide public health and public safety to the people of New York, protect and serve. This happened on their watch, right? Like, even if, like, if you want to blame anyone, let's like look at the fact that homicides did spike, it happened despite spending an enormous amount of money. And what an incredible sleight of hand to be able to say, and just dull, but sleight of hand, unfortunately it works on people, to be able to say, but it was something else that literally barely has had a chance to succeed yet. There are interventions been going on for over half a century, and it's happening on their watch. But the media buys it, and when the media buys it, they spread that and amplify that lie to the people, and we somehow buy it and just like don't think about this. Number two thing that's ridiculous about it is looking at the trends, right? I mean, you mentioned that homicides were up. Also important to note, historically, still way down over the last 20 to 30 years from where they were. I mean, there's a lot less homicides, a lot less shootings. While homicides were up, a lot or most other major crimes were down across the country. And the homicide increase and these other decreases, these patterns held true in when we say across the country. You have to understand, in places that had reform, which are very few places, in all the places that didn't have reform, in places that had police protests, in places that didn't have police protests, in places where police morale was high and low, in red states, blue states. So when I read those statistics, when I made it past the headlines, they're all like FBI data, the crime and homicides at all-time high. What I read as the main takeaway is that it literally undermined a year and a half's worth of effort by the NYPD to lie that bail reform was the cause of anything, good or bad. In their cases, it was bad because it happened everywhere. Yet instead, they were able to, I wouldn't say convince media. Media was just willing to do what they always do and kind of repeat their lies, and people again bought it. So it's a rant.
Yeah. And there's also the second level of error that's happening here with the media. This idea that you can take a national trend and attribute it to local causes,
yes,
is so dishonest. And, I mean, so terrible. It makes me so furious, because why in the world would the same spike happen in New York City and Fort Worth, but you blame it on something that was New York policy based? That doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Right, but this gets into, you know, the important discussion about like journalism and journalists. Like number one, kind of the credulousness of journalists still kind of had how they rely and print police baseline, even not before even having to go into the fact that it's transparently kind of false and not founded in fact, data, or reason. We all know more than ever, because of cell phone footage and because of actually some really good journalism, that police lie. They lie all the time. They lie at things big and small. They lie on the record. They lie in testimony. They lie. We know Dermot Shea. Like Dermot Shea, who for a year and a half was saying bail reform caused gun violence, when confronted by Latrice Walker, an assemblywoman, straight up and said, okay, give me the data to back it up. He said, I don't have any. He said, well, what does your data say? And he said, well, actually, you know, the number of cases of people with gun violence is relatively few to none who are out on bail. So they know, the journalists know that they lie, yet they still continue to rely. And that's number one. Number two, kind of the flip side of that is they don't, and this is on, I think, you know, this is on them, but this is also on, you know, communities and organizers and the ability to kind of connect journalists to other sources. They don't talk to defenders. They don't talk to organizers, people with direct experience, abolitionist academics, folks that really care more about public safety and health than anyone else. And they just continue to rely. And they're also just the data that they use, like they should not be ever relying on short run statistics. And if they do, they should be disclaiming it up and down that there's A, no way to tell causation from short run statistics, and B, we have long-term statistics that show policing is a terrible strategy for public health and safety, and decarceration actually doesn't cause more crime. So better practices needed.
Yeah, and so then there's lately there's been kind of a second twinge of this, which is that, you know, they haven't been talking as much about the gun crimes and stuff being bail reform, but now it's shoplifting and minor crimes that are the result of bail reform. That's the new kind of taste of this thing. So do you have any thoughts about that one?
Yeah, I should have like started up top with this, and hopefully folks have made it this, are going to make it this far into this conversation. We kept their attention, but like,
well, I certainly hope so.
Yeah. But like the, let's talk, but we're talking about is what they're saying true? Like none of it's true. None of the things that they're saying is true, but like, let's talk about like what we do know, like really quickly. And maybe not really quickly. I'm just gonna say, we know that bail reform, to the extent that it still exists, and it does exist in great measure, has been actually an extraordinary success. And I say extraordinary success, also want to say, believing strongly, there are still way too many people caged. There's over 5,000. There are 5,000 people currently in Rikers Island caged pretrial, like thousands more around the state. But it's also an extraordinary success. Oh, nearly 200,000 people statewide have been, are free, who otherwise would have faced the prospect of bail. Now, what's happened with those 200,000 folks? First of all, we've saved over $650 million as taxpayers in avoided costs for their incarceration. And if you care about the fiscal cost. And if you care about public safety, there's been no increase from before bail reform in the number of rearrests for violent crimes. It's non-existent. We're talking on an...
In fact, the data I've seen suggests that it's a slightly... a lower number than before bail reform, at least the dashboards I've looked at.
Oh yeah, folks that are released under folks that who otherwise would have been eligible for bail on any given month, less than 1% of them are rearrested for violent felonies, and even less, it's less than 0.5% are arrested for gun violence. So if right now, I mean, just to put it in perspective, and so it's extraordinarily successful. Right now, Eric Adams is, and we can talk about dangerousness in a second, but he's like, we need to repeal bail reform and allow judges, because it's not successful, we know it's successful, allow judges to take into account someone's dangerousness, right? Their gut feeling of whether someone's dangerous to allow them to be caged. I want your listeners to think about any system that could possibly, without literally having a crystal ball or minority report technology, do a better job of assessing risk than less than 1% of people who are released going on to commit a violent felony, less than 0.5%. You can't get better than this. It's good for public health. It's good for public safety. People are in their jobs with their families. It's enormous cost savings. And we should be like celebrating that. And Democratic lawmakers so far are defending that. And it's just a shame that so many folks are falling victim again to just really transparent fear mongering. We can do better, and we're already seeing really positive results.
And you just mentioned the new mayor, and I think you can draw a somewhat straight line from the beginning of this nonsense straight through to him getting elected. Do you see it as a cause of why Mayor Adams was elected?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one thing that we as folks, as an advocate who cares deeply about truth and justice, and talking about and pushing for and advocating for policies that do better for all of us, we can't lose sight of the fact that Democrats, liberals, progressives, and across all, you know, diversities and spectrums are also beholden to the same kind of entrenched understanding of crime and politics that we were born with, popular culture, media. And this includes people who live in communities that are most over-policed. And so, you know, I think Mayor Adams' election, despite the fact that it's not just that he's a former police officer, but that he ran on this kind of very conservative, right, fear-mongering, tough-on-crime agenda, the fact that he was elected is really a symbol of how far we have to go with even on the left, not even on the left, like very much so on the left. And we're seeing this. It's not just in New York. We're seeing it with Lori Lightfoot in Chicago. We're seeing it with Garcetti in Los Angeles and London Breed's most recent kind of nod and caving to the fear mongering, calling for, you know, an emergency and calling for more police to arrest people in need instead of helping them. We have a lot to do. To bring, you know, who should be allies, people who ostensibly care about civil rights, people who ostensibly care about, you know, all the things we've been talking about, to kind of see the light.
Well, and there's so many just unbelievably terrible things that come from this. I mean, when he first got elected, the two first things I remember him doing are saying, let's reinstate solitary at Rikers. And let's get rid of the I think he got rid of the convictions integrity unit. Did he do that, or that was there one in the first place? Maybe not that one. But then he gave a speech that you commented on, that he said that there was no form of order in our cities, and suggested that anything goes in New York City and other places. Your response was that this reminded you of Trump's American Carnage speech, and I think that's a fair comparison. And it sounds like we both agree that New York isn't an anarchist wasteland, right? Right?
No, and it's look, like, one thing to say is that, like, literally any single person that is harmed or hurt or shot or killed, it's an enormous tragedy. Like, that's like, it is a problem. If it's one, it's a problem. And there are too many people, right? We can talk about historical context. We can talk about the fact that it's not as bad as they say it is. That is a problem. And if you actually care, if we actually care, and I do, about people getting shot and guns on the streets and all that stuff, like, you need to follow the facts. And you need to actually, like, look into policies and practices that are actually going to stop that and make people safer. That's the thing that's just, like, I don't want to lose sight of, right? Where it's like, so that's one. Two, no, it's not anarchy. And three, it really did feel, you know, when he won, and by the way, with significantly, I mean, I don't know what was percentage of vote. It was not that many.
I forget, but yeah, it was.
But when he won, it felt like, it didn't feel yet like Trump winning at all. I mean, nothing will ever feel like that, I don't think it can. But then when he started coming out with these statements before he even started, when his first order of business was going to be expanding the torture of solitary confinement, when he then, before, it was either before or right after he came into office on that front, responded to the majority of city council asking him to reconsider by saying, you have essentially, he didn't say this exactly, but you have no cause to question what I do because you've never been a police officer before.
I remember that,
Felt like that feeling of, wow, it is way worse than I already thought it was going to be. And I remember talking to advocates and being like, it's going to be a really, this is terrifying. It's going to be a really long fight. It just keeps getting worse.
But then it keeps getting worse. But then we have the president of the United States, who is supposed to, you know, at least ostensibly, we were talking about the left-right divide a second ago, although obviously he has a history with, MasterCard. I'm just saying, he comes in and he was holding up Mayor Adams like some kind of a role model for what he'd like to see other leaders across the Democratic Party look like. This is pretty terrifying to me. We have the leadership of one of our two parties actively pushing for dictatorship, and the leadership of the other one, moving from George Floyd to American carnage in less than 2 years. How did we get from millions of people in the streets to Empire Strikes Back in 2 years?
By electing Joe Biden. I don't know. I mean,
but what was the alternative? Trump, right? I mean,
obviously at that point, exactly. But it was like who we chose as the standard bearer. But since we brought Joe Biden into the picture, the things that I think about there too is it's way worse than I could have ever imagined on the criminal justice front. I mean, the fact, and again, I had low expectations, obviously, but it's way worse. He is still to this day, correct me if I'm wrong, but he still has yet to use his presidential constitutional power to grant a single clemency or pardon. He has literally granted more pardons to turkeys than he has to human beings. Number one, if there is no stronger sign of just an abdication of morality and abdication of power to do like the slightest bit of good than to issue a single part. We're talking about,
plus he has 18,000 on his desk. It's not like, it's not like it's.
Well, I don't want to line, and the last thing I don't want in the world, I want to line draw. I mean, there's, I don't know all the 18,000 or whatever. But like the fact that he hasn't even, if he's in his head, it's like trying to understand, right? It's if there is a worry about political blowback of certain people who we would pardon. First of all, use the power of your microphone and stand behind what you do and use that to shift the narrative around violent crime versus nonviolent crime. But the fact that there's tens of thousands of people, I don't know the actual numbers, that's currently in federal custody for marijuana, that he won't even do that is really something terrifying. That's
And he also, the Biden Sanders unity plan, he promised to move clemency out of the DOJ, and the whole reason that one of the main arguments for doing that is it creates another kind of insulation so that when they recommend a bunch of people for clemency, that at least gives you some if you've got to have plausible deniability, that you've got some. But he didn't even do that. He promised to do that, and he didn't even do that.
And let me tell you also, just in addition to this, for literally months and months and months, the attention and of so many advocates were focused on something that is just focused on fighting for something that eventually came true. But the fact that we had to spend so much energy fighting was remarkable. During the Trump years, under the CARES Act, he released something like, 3,000, 5,000, maybe there's more, thousands of folks who applied to be put in house and released to home arrest or to home confinement because of COVID. And these were folks that were vetted heavily by the government, and they were out and thriving. It's similar to the bail conversation. An exceptionally small number of people wind up getting sent back to prison for violating the conditions of their release. And Biden comes into power, and his DOJ and Merrick Garland interprets this memo to say they all got to be sent back as soon as the emergency order lifts. And then after some blowback, he pushed back and said, okay, just the folks who are not out on drug crimes, all the other stuff need to be sent back, rip them from their families, and put the most number of people in the history in one fell swoop into federal prison.
Also, let's not forget that another one of his campaign promises was to reduce the federal prison population by over 50%. he really did say that. I'm not making that up.
He's literally doing everything he possibly can. And finally, I think it was like 2 months ago, Merrick Garland came out and said, finally, he's like, we're not going to do this. Good. Great. Why do we have to fight for so long for the most obvious thing? And again, the understanding was there was some concern about political blowback.
Yeah, I mean, I did.
So easy.
I did two 24-hour Twitter events on that subject. And with the whole time in my head, I'm going, why is this even something we're fighting
Should
about?
have had to spend a minute. And there's so much injustice, and there's so many things like all over the country that we need to be fighting for. Why do we need to be fighting for the most easiest, obvious stuff? So yeah, Biden coming in and propping up Mayor Adams was not surprising and also highly disappointing. One thing that I think is important to note is that Biden stayed, my understanding is that I have information very purposefully so, far away from any conversations around pretrial detention, dangerousness, and bail. He focused exclusively on policing. And one thing I do want to call out is that in the mayor's mind, some of the stuff that Biden talked about, and he wrote about this in the New York Daily News, it's not enough, but they did talk about some things, because we're talking about how horrible the current system is, some things that actually like have been proven to work elsewhere and some more investment in. I'm not endorsing Adams' plan, but I do want to use the opportunity to call out like violence interruption programs. These are programs where folks who have been harmed by and have also harmed others, is usually an overlap, who have done time. Their community work with community to connect and solve problems before they become actual conflicts, or step in ahead of time, or after violence has happened, work through a restorative justice approach. And the places where this has been tried throughout the country in far too small numbers, it's been way more successful when compared to similar neighborhoods, than really more of a responsive. Both the responsive kind of situation of policing, not to mention the inability for them to solve crimes, but also like the criminogenic nature of policing. In the same way we talked about earlier, like jails being characterized by the same drivers of violence, like policing right now. Like when you, I did not live in an over-policed neighborhood. The people I represented did, and I would often every day, most days I would be there. Just being on a block and seeing 10 police cars drive by in the span of 30 seconds, and seeing these like floodlights at night and this ever police presence. People that I represented talked about feeling imprisoned in their own neighborhoods. And so, yeah, we can't lose sight of the fact that it's not that we need alternatives to incarceration, as basically said, alternatives to policing just because they work better. We also know that policing itself actually causes crime.
So, as we kind of turn the corner here, I guess the next thing, I was going to talk a little bit about Alvin Bragg. I mean, obviously it's sort of the same story we've been telling all the way through. But a lot of what we're talking about is kind of and I think I said this up top, kind of an almost a collusion, a natural relationship between law enforcement, press departments, and the actual media. And you're starting to fight back against this with the no whatever the new organization, which you can definitely talk about some more. What how do we how are we I mean, we have thousands of organizations across this country. All of us are, fairly busy doing specific work in the areas we're in, but it seems like there has to be some way that we can pivot and at least use our combined powers to try to break through in some way, or to work together to break through in some way, or to at least counter this narrative that keeps getting that this mostly false, almost entirely false narrative that keeps getting shoved down everyone's throats and is successful. I mean, we've talked about, it changing elections, and people's perceptions seem to be that we're the crazy people, even though the data is all on our side, which is, and I don't mean crazy in a pejorative, like anti-mental illness kind of way. I mean, just like people think that we are wrong, even though the data is all on our side.
So I'll tell you about the kind of the framing of the work that Zealous is doing, and I because I think it kind of reflects a lot of the kind of the nature of what's needed right now, in kind of like multi-pronged approach. First, we need to recognize that we are in a current national reckoning over people's basic perceptions of crime and justice and what it's going to take to achieve public health and safety. And for the last 50 years, and that continues to today, it's been controlled by really strong, coordinated messaging and storytelling by pro-carceral forces, police, prosecutors, and prisons. And by that side, by high coordination, by kind of collaboration and being on the same page. My organization, Zealous, really aims to do what I think we need to do, which is topple this imbalance of power and control over criminal legal policy and media. To not just fight back effectively, but to really ensure, like not ensure more than just modest changes, but like transformative changes that then are enduring. Like I don't want us to be constantly in this position, and I don't think anyone does, of like doing a little modest win and then just like constantly fighting. Like let's create the environment. So how do we, how are we doing that? We are, one is really leaning in heavily on our defender and defense practice. So thinking about defenders in defense offices as you know, just thousands and thousands of untapped kind of social justice champions, folks who are experts and have extraordinary perspective and important relationships with the people they represent, to step outside of court, to leverage this range of storytelling skills and media skills that they didn't learn in law school. And then offices wide, actually optimize them, help defender offices get optimized to be able to share data that otherwise wouldn't be shareable, to share systemic injustices that no one's writing about, to breathe life into those systemic injustices with true life stories in a way that's not extractive and exploitative of the people who are going through it. If defender offices can get more engaged, I think that's a big part of it. The second piece, as you mentioned, coordination, collaboration. Right? It's not enough just for defenders to like start speaking out, especially if they do so without intention. Defenders collaborating with what are previously siloed groups, so defenders, organizers, people with direct experience communities, and even artists. What might it look like if we broke down those silos and everyone was working together and thinking through strategically what one side could say and what another side could and actually develop true coalitions. And so what we're trying to do is model some of what has been really successful in New York, which is true collaboration between defenders and community organizations, really breaking down that distrust. And what might that look like to strengthen in New York and elsewhere. And so we're doing a lot of work with kind of at these intersection points, like working with organizers and defender offices, working with folks on the inside who are currently incarcerated, with advocates on the outside and vice versa to strengthen that practice. And lastly, like a lot of this truth and justice work, like while we're doing this kind of organizing and training up and skill building, capacity building, we're also just working directly with journalists. So, you know, this Justice Not Fear project is a way to provide them with the truth, like legal expertise. We're also talk about organizing. We're trying to bring journalists in the same way that they've got those long-term relationships of trust with police. We want to help them build really strong relationships of trust with folks on the ground who know what's actually going on, who truly care, who know the facts, I mean, who can speak to their experience and vice versa. So it's about like what we need to do. It's got to be a multi-pronged approach. I think it can't be in just one jurisdiction. We're seeing the one thing that is like one, it's a silver lining of just how ridiculous the kind of the police tactics are, is that they're so common. And they're the same things and the same patterns. They do everything. We see the same things in all the progressive cities, for example. And so I think there's a great potential right now to kind of do, if, and I'm seeing this actually happening, it needs to happen more, coordination between advocates who are really honed in and focused on this issue in those various jurisdictions. Share what's working, share what's not, and kind of build from there. And another silver lining piece about COVID, which is weird, or just silver lining, this one happens to be about COVID, which is weird but true, at least in my work I've seen in the social justice sphere, Zoom and our like ability to like be on Zoom and see people has really increased the ability to grow and strengthen trust in coalitions that are separated by geography, and a phone call would never have worked in the past. I've seen that there's actually great potential for that kind of coordination.
So ultimately, you know, I've asked a version of the question I just asked you a bunch of different people over the last year, and I've gotten all kinds of different answers. I've gotten answers like everyone needs to create their own platform. I've got answers like we need to hijack traditional platforms. We need to have people represented in traditional media. We need to have, there's just a ton of different answers. And I'm sure to some extent it's all of these, the above is what we probably need to do. But do you have a feeling though for, I understand you're doing all this stuff, but you know, I mean, just the other day, I turn on the television, it's Morning Joe, and if all people, civil rights icon, Reverend Al, is sitting there talking about how we need to lock more people up because toothpaste is getting locked up in his convenience stores because of, because of shoplifting. And I'm just like, what in the world is happening here? Like, I just feel like, you know, we've got more people than ever, more information than ever, and we're still losing, you know, in the media battle.
Yeah, what it's going to take is it's working directly with journalists. It's working directly with newsrooms. It's working directly with editors to call them in. Calling out only goes so far, but calling them in and really, I think, you know, training them on a range of things, from using humanizing language to thinking more critically about sources. And the sources are not just, don't just talk to the police, and actually don't talk to the police at all because they're interested. And if you're going to quote them, say that. But also, don't just go to the like traditional talking heads who are actually not deeply rooted in community, or not defenders and fighting every day in court, who are not organizers, who are not, abolitionists. Abolitionist is like this dirty word. Like, you know, you mentioned the word quote unquote crazy. People are like, your ideas are nuts. Like, no, like, I think it's nuts to continue doing what we're doing right now. The folks who are thinking the most critically are the ones that are most critical of our current system. And so I think, you know, in addition to the ground level work, it's also really talking to and doing the really hard work with journalists. I'll just say though the work that we're doing we're at this national organization, but the problem with national organizations generally is they kind of swoop in and screw things up and bounce around. Our approach is really, we don't invite ourselves in, but when we're invited in, it's all supporting like long-term capacity building. We're in for we're not going to see this. It's not going to take a couple months. Like, we're going to have some losses along the way. This is a multi-year, at the very least, battle. And I think we're in this position where if we work with press and we get them to think about the project that we're working on as a project for truth and truthfully objectivity, and show that it will actually improve journalism, not to mention like lives. And we, you know, build a long-term, you know, like strengthen coalition on the ground, skill folks up to be able to be more fluent in talking about these issues in a way that translate them for the general public, that can be where they can actually be brought onto shows instead of the Al Sharptons of the world. I think we're going to be in a better place long term. But we need to focus on, honestly, we need to focus on better journalism as a social and racial justice imperative. Like that is a human rights issue. That is a civil rights issue right now. Like, we can't anymore think about media as separate from people in cages. There is a direct line from bad journalistic practices to harm. Yes, other folks carry out the harm, pass the policies, support the policies, actually do the caging, but media literally makes it happen. We have to not lose sight of that.
I agree with you there. So people really liked this last year. I asked if there were any criminal justice related books that they might recommend others. So I'm bringing it back. Are there any books you've read recently that you might recommend?
Oh man.
And if not,
I'm trying to think, like, how long ago have I, Well, I mean, look, I'm going to say the books that you know what? Actually, no, I was going to say book. I was going to say, look, Mariam.
You could say more than one.
So. I know Mariam Kaba's book is extraordinary. It's a collection of speaking of abolitionists being absolutely the most reasonable people always in the room. Yes, radical.
Yeah, it's right up here on the bookshelf.
It's that. I'm literally trying to find. Oh, here it is. A copy of this new book that was put out by PEN America. It's called The Sentences That Create Us. I'm actually like halfway through, but I've got a head start on it because I work closely with Kate, who's the head of PEN America. And it's a collection of essays on writing in a variety of contexts, in media, different mediums, for people who are incarcerated. But the lesson, and it's written by people who either are currently or were firmly incarcerated. But they come with, first of all, the lessons are kind of broadly applicable, I think, to all kinds of advocacy and best practices and collaborations. But they also come with actual exercises that you can do. And so it's an extraordinary book. The Sentences That Create Us, one of the coolest things, among many cool things, is that they got significant funding to be able to provide something like 75,000 copies to people who are currently incarcerated.
Oh, that's awesome.
I think the Mellon Foundation. And I'm in talking with PEN America, we're also going to get these into the hands of as many public defenders as possible, for them to be thinking more critically about the experience of incarceration, how they can partner with the people they represent more effectively. It's just a beautifully written book. And my colleague, Alejo Rodriguez, he's our director of collaborative advocacy, wrote an essay in this work. So also proud to know one of the co-authors. But it's a series of essays. Highly recommend.
Well, I can't really let you get away after what you said earlier without asking if you have any particular favorite drummers, because music is something that comes up on here quite a bit.
God, so many. I mean, who are in my head right now? Let's go. I've been listening again, as always. I go through one of my favorite bands, so Ringo Starr. He always gets a bad rap because super simple.
But he was a very clever player. He was
beautiful.
No doubt.
John Bonham, of course. Dave Grohl. More recently, he's like the heir to.
I wish he played more drums these days. He is a great drummer.
Dennis Chambers, just in terms of chops. Oh God, I was watching, you know, I'm a little embarrassed to say, I don't know like how they're perceived these days, but like last night, for whatever reason, down a YouTube rabbit hole,
I do that a lot.
I came across the drummer. Remember that band Mute Math that was like around in like the 2000s? There was like this like really, it was like hit song. It was called, I forget what it was called. But like, hadn't even thought about them for 21 years. Anyway, the drummer for them, I think it's like Devin King or something like this showed up, and him now. And he was like a historian about music and about drummers. And he not only talked beautifully about it, but his playing is extraordinary. Man, give me some more. The drummer from Fugazi, speaking of DC.
I mean, I'm a Fugazi guy. So, I don't know if you've ever heard, there's a band now called Black Midi. I'm not like a huge fan of them, but their drummer is actually quite good. That's one I would throw out just off the top of my head, who's a recent drummer who's pretty good.
I may be remiss if I didn't mention Danny Carey from Tool, one of my favorite.
Oh, yeah. They were just in town. They were just in Detroit last night, I think.
I've seen them a lot. I've seen them actually like 14 times. My brother and I are huge Tool fans. I also happen to love, I mean, look, I love all kinds of music, like literally everything, but also recently have gotten really into like kind of, I don't even know what you call like growl rock, like really intense heavy metal, very fast, like blast beat stuff. I'm loving right now Meshuggah, that have for a while. Their drummer, Thomas Hockey, is one of the most extraordinary drummers. So their music's insane, and not in a shouldn't use that word. It's a problematic word.
Yeah, I know I do that sometimes too.
No,
I caught myself earlier.
But what's amazing about it for the drummers out there is that the top beats, it's all in 4/4. So you can bob your head to it. It's like 1, 2, 3, really heavy. And his kick drums are doing the most insane polyrhythms that like literally last, you know, 20, sometimes 30, you know, 30 bars. And it's just, it's also so. And I would be remiss, Tame Impala, which is really just Kevin Parker. He plays all the instruments. I think he's one of the most underrated drummers out there. Also bassists, but his drumming is spectacular. Also really simple, very like similar vibe to Ringo Starr in that it's like less is far more.
I am definitely a Ringo Starr, Charlie Watts kind of less is more kind of feel drummer, so I appreciate that a great deal. I always ask the same last question. What did I mess up? What question should I have asked but did not?
Oh man, I mean, you would never have thought to ask this question, but like, what does my son think about what I do? He's only
Oh,
six.
that's a great question. I'd love to hear the answer to that. Go ahead. Yeah.
So I talked to my son, he's 6 years old about stuff all the time. And first of all, he knows, he's, even though I'm not currently practicing, it's painful for me. He still considers me currently a public defender. And if you ask him, what do public defenders do? He will say proudly, get people out of jail, free them. But he also just has, and I think this is, I don't think unique to him, although we really talk about these issues. He's like a really, like for like, young kids, like have this really kind of sense of the obviousness of injustice. So like he'll say things like so anyway, he's very proud of what I do because he'll say things that like he's really affected by when he sees people that don't have homes. And he'll see like a big building going up and they'll just like strike him. He's like, Dad, I've got a great idea. Like, what's going on? He's like, there's space there. Why don't we just have people go into this new fancy condo, which is going to cost like $6,000 a month, whatever it is. And it's like having to talk to him about why and the questions that then come up, why? Or he really understands this. Someone was pretending to like be a police officer and said, I'm going to put you in jail. And he was really affected by that. He was like, don't you realize that like if you're mad at me, that's going to make me worse. That's going to make me more mad. And so he has understands that this really elemental version of what we were talking about earlier, where it's like if you put someone in a really violent, horrific place, that's not going to actually solve any problems. So he's a good kid. He's
You would like to think it was pretty intuitive. It seems intuitive to me, you know.
I think so, but it's this, but and he's also right. So like who knows if he would be there if we didn't at this point at 6 going on 7, if we didn't talk about this all the time, given that, he does watch Paw Patrol and it's like about police and they're nice and no one gets put in jail. At least I don't think. But yeah, I wonder like at what age people's opinions really start getting formed. And I think it's like pretty early on. He asked another amazing question the other day. When he was looking at he was looking at a police officer. So why do police get to have guns if they shoot so many people? I was like, good question.
Britain, Great Britain used to have a much better answer to that. They don't. I don't know. Your thing about the houses kind of reminds me. I don't know if you ever saw the old George Carlin bit about homelessness and golf courses, but
Remind
that's,
me, Roger, I don't know. I didn't.
I mean, he basically just said, why do we have all these golf courses and homeless people? Which, I mean, why are we spending all this money to enclave all this territory across our country when people don't have places to live, which seems like a
I could have
reasonable
seen
question
where
to me.
that was going. It makes sense.
Well, I really appreciate you doing this. It's always great to get to talk to you. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Now, my take. One thing we have definitely learned over the last 5 or 6 years is that the truth is no longer necessary in moving the needle. What seems to matter most, as Orwell foretold, is repeating the same false information over and over again, as loudly as possible. Oh, and also, if possible, make sure the people repeating that false information also wears a badge or the conservative suit of a prosecuting attorney. That might seem hyperbolic, but what we've seen almost for almost 3 years, is like an endless drumbeat from tabloid press outlets combined with the media arms of New York law enforcement blaming criminal justice reform for crime when most of the increases in crime happened on their watch. As I've said many times before, the increase in homicides is a nationwide problem. It's happened in places with criminal justice reform, without criminal justice reform, in places with GOP mayors, with Democratic mayors, and in places with increased and decreased police funding. This was not about reform, but it does say something about our approach to crime. As long as we continue to believe that bringing the entire weight of the government down with both feet on individuals who commit crimes, instead of putting any investment into addressing the things that actually cause crime, we will continue to fail. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who've joined us from Patreon or have given a donation. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or add us on Stitcher, Spotify, or from your favorite podcast app. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, to Ann Espo for helping with our transcripts and social media images, and to Alex Mayo, who helps with our website. Make sure and add us on your social media and share our posts across your networks. Also thanks to my employer, Safe and Just Michigan, for helping to support the Decarceration Nation podcast. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.